Many consider themselves anti-capitalist or anti-war activists, or at least they were fond of the recreational drugs these activists enjoyed, and now they were riding elevators with a bunch of suits at 30 Rockefeller Center, where the show's studio was being built. We were all like 21 or 22 years old. We didn't have any money or any clue what we were doing, so we spent all of our time trying to make each other laugh, Schiller told me. We'd eat every meal together. We'd go to the same bars each night. We were terrified that if we separated, one of us might get lost and never be heard from again. In subsequent years, as Saturday Night Live became one of the most popular and longest-running programs in television history, a kind of mythology emerged. In the early days of SNL, the journalist Malcolm Gladwell wrote in 2002, everyone knew everyone, and everyone was always in everyone else's business. And that fact goes a long way toward explaining the extraordinary chemistry among the show's cast. There are books filled with stories of John Belushi breaking into castmates' apartments to make spaghetti late at night, or setting their guest bedrooms on fire with carelessly handled joints, or writers gluing one another's furniture to the ceilings, or prank calling one another's offices, or ordering 30 pizzas to the news division and then dressing up like security guards so they could infiltrate the lower floors, steal the pizza, and leave the journalists with the bill. There are flowcharts detailing who from SNL slept with whom. They tend to get complicated, because Michaels was married to writer Rosie Schuster, who eventually ended up with Dan Aykroyd, who had dated Gilda Radner, who everyone suspected was in love with writer Alan Zweibel, who later wrote a book explaining they were in love, but nothing ever happened. And besides, Radner later married a member of the SNL band. It was the 1970s. Miller told me. Sex was what you did. Saturday Night Live has been held up as a model of great team dynamics. It is cited in college textbooks as an example of what groups can achieve when the right conditions are in place and a team intensely bonds. The group that created Saturday Night Live came together so successfully, this theory goes, because a communal culture replaced individual needs. There were shared experiences. We were all the kids who didn't get to sit at the popular table in high school, Beats told me. Common social networks. Lorne was a cult leader, said writer Bruce McCall. As long as you had a Mooney-like devotion to the group, you were fine. And group needs trumped individual egos. I don't mean this in a bad way, but we were Guyana on the 17th floor, said Zweibel. It was a stalag. But this theory becomes considerably more complicated when you speak to the people on the original Saturday Night Live team. It's true those writers and actors spent enormous amounts of time together and developed a strong sense of unity, but not because of forced intimacy or shared history or because they particularly liked each other. In fact, the group norms at Saturday Night Live created as many tensions as strengths. There was a tremendous amount of competitiveness and infighting, said Beats. We were so young, and no one knew how to control themselves. We fought all the time. One night in the writers' room, Beats made a joke that they were lucky Hitler had killed 6 million Jews, because otherwise no one would have found an apartment in New York City. Marilyn Miller didn't speak to me for 2 weeks, she said. Marilyn was completely uptight about jokes about Hitler. I think she hated me at that point. We would glare at each other for hours. There were jealousies and rivalries, battles for Michaels' affection, competition for airtime. You wanted your sketch to go on, which meant someone else's would have to get cut, said Beats. If you were succeeding, someone else was failing. Even the closest relationships, such as between Alan Zweibel and Gilda Radner, were fraught. Gilda and I came up with this character, Roseanne Rosanna Dana, and on Friday I would go into the office and stay up all night writing the script, like 8 or 9 pages, said Zweibel. Then Gilda would arrive mid-morning, totally refreshed, and take a red pen and start crossing shit out, like she was some kind of school marm, and I would get pissed. So I would go back to my office and rework everything, and she would do it again. By the time the show went on, we usually weren't speaking to each other. I once stopped writing sketches for her for 3 weeks. I purposely saved my best stuff for other people. Furthermore, it's not entirely true that members of the SNL team enjoyed spending time together. Garrett Morris, the show's only black actor, felt like an outcast and planned to quit as soon as he had enough money. Jane Curtin would escape to her home and husband as soon as the show was done for the week. People would form allegiances and then get into fights and then form counter-allegiances. Everyone was in these cliques that were constantly shifting, said Bruce McCall, who came aboard as a writer for the show's second season. It was a pretty dismal place. In some ways, it's remarkable the Saturday Night Live team gelled at all. Michaels, it turned out, had chosen everyone precisely because of their disparate tastes. Zweibel was a specialist in borscht belt one-liners. Michael O'Donohue wrote dark, bitter satires about such topics as the assassination of JFK. When a distraught secretary told O'Donohue that Elvis had died, he replied, "Smart career move." Tom Schiller aspired to direct art films. And everyone could become scathing critics when their sensibilities clashed. "Great, Garrett," O'Donohue once said when he read a script the actor had spent weeks writing. Then he dropped it into a trash can. Real good. "Comedy writers carry a lot of anger," said Schiller. "We were vicious to each other. If you thought something was funny and no one else did, it could be brutal." So why, given all the tensions and infighting, did the Saturday Night Live creators become such an effective, productive team? The answer isn't that they spent so much time together, or that the show's norms put the needs of the group above individual egos. Rather, the SNL team clicked because, surprisingly, they all felt safe enough around one another to keep pitching new jokes and ideas. The writers and actors worked amid norms that made everyone feel like they could take risks and be honest with one another, even as they were shooting down ideas, undermining one another, and competing for airtime. "You know that saying, 'there's no I in team'?" Michaels told me. "My goal was the opposite of that. All I wanted were a bunch of I's. I wanted everyone to hear each other, but no one to disappear into the group." That's how psychological safety emerged. Imagine you have been invited to join one of two teams. Team A is composed of 8 men and 2 women, all of whom are exceptionally smart and successful. When you watch a video of them working together, you see articulate professionals who take turns speaking and are polite and courteous. At some point, when a question arises, one person, clearly an expert on the topic, speaks at length while everyone else listens. No one interrupts. When another person veers off topic, a colleague gently reminds him of the agenda and steers the conversation back on track. The team is efficient. The meeting ends exactly when scheduled. Team B is different. It's evenly divided among men and women, some of whom are successful executives, while others are middle managers with little in the way of professional achievements. On a video, you see teammates jumping in and out of a discussion haphazardly. Some ramble at length, others are curt. They interrupt one another so much, it's sometimes hard to follow the conversation. When a team member abruptly changes the topic or loses sight of their point, the rest of the group follows him off the agenda. At the end of the meeting doesn't actually end. Everyone sits around and gossips. Which group would you rather join? Before you decide, imagine you are given one additional piece of information. When both teams first formed, each member was asked to complete what's known as the reading the mind in the eyes test. They were each shown 36 photos of people's eyes and asked to choose which word, among 4 offered, best describe the emotion that person was feeling. This test, you are told, measures people's empathy. The members of Team A picked the right emotion on average 49% of the time. Team B, 58%. Does that change your mind? In 2008, a group of psychologists from Carnegie Mellon and MIT wondered if they could figure out which kinds of teams were clearly superior. As research, management, and many other kinds of tasks are increasingly accomplished by groups, both those working face-to-face and virtually, it is becoming even more important to understand the determinants of group performance, the researchers wrote in the journal Science in 2010. Over the last century, psychologists made significant progress in defining and systematically measuring intelligence in individuals. We have used the statistical approach they developed for individual intelligence to systematically measure the intelligence of groups. Put differently, the researchers wanted to know if there is a collective intelligence that emerges within a team that is distinct from the smarts of any single member. To accomplish this, the researchers recruited 699 people, divided them into 152 teams, and gave each group a series of assignments that required different kinds of cooperation. Most teams began by spending 10 minutes brainstorming possible uses for a brick and received a point for each unique idea. Then they were asked to plan a shopping trip as if they were housemates sharing a single car. Each teammate was given a different list of groceries to buy and a map showing prices at various stores. The only way to maximize the team's score was for each person to sacrifice one item they really wanted in exchange for something that pleased the entire group. Then the teams were told to arrive at a ruling on a disciplinary case in which a college basketball player allegedly bribed his teacher. Some teammates represented the interests of the faculty. Others were stand-ins for the athletics department. Points were awarded for reaching a verdict that maximized each group's concerns. Each of these tasks required full team participation. Each demanded different kinds of collaboration. As the researchers observed groups going about the tasks, they saw various dynamics emerge. Some teams came up with dozens of clever uses for the brick, arrived at a verdict that made everyone happy, and easily divvied up the shopping trip. Others kept describing the same uses for the brick in different words, came to verdicts that left some participants feeling alienated, and managed to buy only ice cream and Fruit Loops because no one was willing to compromise. What was interesting was that teams that did well on one assignment also seemed to do well on the others. Conversely, teams that failed at one thing seemed to fail at everything. Some might have hypothesized that the good teams were successful because their members were smarter, that group intelligence might be nothing more than the intelligence of the individuals making up the team. But the researchers had tested participants' IQs beforehand and found that individual intelligence didn't correlate with team performance. Putting 10 smart people in a room didn't mean they solved problems more intelligently. In fact, those smart people were often outperformed by groups consisting of people who had scored lower on intellect tests, but who still seemed smarter as a group. Others might have argued that the good teams had more decisive leaders, but the research showed that wasn't right either. The researchers eventually concluded that the good teams had succeeded not because of innate qualities of team members, but because of how they treated one another. Put differently, the most successful teams had norms that caused everyone to mesh particularly well. We find converging evidence of a general collective intelligence factor that explains a group's performance on a wide variety of tasks, the researchers wrote in their Science article. This kind of collective intelligence is a property of the group itself, not just the individuals in it. It was the norms, not the people, that made teams so smart. The right norms could raise the collective intelligence of mediocre thinkers. The wrong norms could hobble a group made up of people who, on their own, were all exceptionally bright. But when the researchers reviewed videos of the good teams' interactions, they noticed that not all norms looked alike. "It was striking how different some of them behaved," said Anita Woolley, the study's lead author. "Some teams had a bunch of smart people who figured out how to break up work evenly. Other groups had pretty average members, but came up with ways to take advantage of everyone's relative strengths. Some groups had one strong leader. Others were more fluid, and everyone took a leadership role." There were, however, two behaviors that all the good teams shared. First, all the members of the good team spoke in roughly the same proportion, a phenomenon the researchers referred to as equality in distribution of conversational turn-taking. In some teams, for instance, everyone spoke during each task. In other groups, conversation ebbed from assignment to assignment, but by the end of the day, everyone had spoken roughly the same amount. "As long as everyone got a chance to talk, the team did well," said Woolley. "But if only one person or a small group spoke all the time, the collective intelligence declined. The conversations didn't need to be equal every minute, but in aggregate, they had to balance out." Second, the good teams tested as having high average social sensitivity, a fancy way of saying that the groups were skilled at intuiting how members felt based on their tone of voice, how people held themselves, and the expressions on their faces. One of the easiest ways to gauge social sensitivity is to show someone photos of people's eyes and ask them to describe what that person is thinking or feeling, the empathy test described previously. This is a test of how well the participant can put themselves into the mind of the other person and tune in to their mental state, wrote the creator of the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, Simon Baron Cohen of the University of Cambridge. While men, on average, correctly guessed the emotion of the person in the photo only 52% of the time, women typically guess right 61%. People on the good teams in Woolley's experiment scored above average on the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test. They seemed to know when someone was feeling upset or left out. They spent time asking one another what they were thinking about. The good teams also contained more women. Coming back to the question of which team to join, if you are given a choice between the serious-minded professional Team A or the free-flowing, more informal Team B, you should opt for Team B. Team A is smart and filled with effective colleagues. As individuals, they will all be successful. But as a team, they still tend to act like individuals. There's little to suggest that as a group, they become collectively intelligent, because there's little evidence that everyone has an equal voice and that members are sensitive to teammates' emotions and needs. In contrast, Team B is messier. People speak over one another. They go on tangents. They socialize instead of remaining focused on the agenda. Everyone speaks as much as they need to, though. They feel equally heard and are attuned to one another's body language and expressions. They try to anticipate how one another will react. Team B may not contain as many individual stars, but when that group unites, the sum is much greater than any of its parts. If you ask the original Saturday Night Live team why the show was such a success, they'll talk about Lorne Michaels. "There's something about his leadership," they'll say, "that made everything come together. He had an ability to make everyone feel heard, to make even the most self-centered actors and writers pay attention to each other. His eye for talent is nearly unrivaled in entertainment over the last 40 years. You'll also find people who say that Michaels is aloof, socially awkward, proud, and jealous, and that when he decides to fire someone, he'll cut them completely adrift. You might not want Michaels as a friend. But as the leader of Saturday Night Live, what he's created is extraordinary. One of the longest-running shows in history, built on the talent of egomaniacal comedians who, 20 times a year for 4 decades, have put their craziness aside just long enough to make a live television program with only a week's preparation. Michaels himself, still the show's executive producer, says the reason why Saturday Night Live has succeeded is because he works hard to force people to become a team. The secret to making that happen, he says, is giving everyone a voice and finding people willing to be sensitive enough to listen to one another. Lorne was deliberate about making sure everyone got a chance to pitch their ideas, the writer Marilyn Miller told me. He would say, "Do we have pieces for the girls this week? Who hasn't been on in a while?" He has this kind of psychic ability to draw in everyone, said Alan Zweibel. I honestly believe that's why the show has existed for 40 years. At the top of each script, there's a list of the initials of everyone who worked on that sketch, and Lorne has always said he's happiest the more initials he sees. Michaels is almost ostentatious in his demonstrations of social sensitivity, and he expects the cast and writers to mimic him. During the early years of the show, he was the one who appeared with a soothing word when an exhausted writer was crying in his office. He has been known to interrupt a rehearsal or table read and quietly take an actor aside to ask if they need to talk about something going on in their personal life. Once, when the writer Michael O'Donohue was inordinately proud of an obscene commercial parody, Michaels ordered it read at 18 different rehearsals, even though everyone knew the network censors would never let it on the air. I remember walking up to Lorne once and saying, "Okay, here's my idea. It's a bunch of girls at their first slumber party, and they're telling each other how sex works." And Lorne said, "Write it up, just like that. No questions asked." Then he took an index card and put it on the board for the next show. That sketch, which appeared on Saturday Night Live on May 8, 1976, became one of the show's most famous pieces. "I was on top of the world," said Miller. "He's got this social ESP. Sometimes he knows exactly what will make you feel like the most important person on earth." Many of the original actors and writers on Saturday Night Live weren't particularly easy to get along with. They freely admit that, even today, they are combative and gossipy and sometimes downright mean. But when they worked together, they were careful with one another's feelings. Michael O'Donohue might have dropped Garrett Morris's script into a trash can, but he made a point afterward to tell Morris he was joking. And when Morris suggested an idea about a depressing children's story, O'Donohue came up with "The Little Train That Died." "I know I can, I know I can. Heart attack, heart attack. Oh my God, the pain." The SNL team avoided picking fights with one another. "When I made that Hitler joke, Marilyn wouldn't speak to me," Beats told me. "But that's the point. She didn't speak. She didn't escalate it into a whole big thing." People might have criticized one another's ideas, but they were careful about how far they let their critiques go. They disagreed and clashed, but everyone still had a voice at each table read, and despite the sniping and competition, they were oddly protective of one another. Everyone liked everyone else, or at least worked hard to pretend like they liked everyone, said Don Novello, a writer on the show in the 1970s and 80s, and the actor who played Father Guido Sarducci. "We genuinely trusted each other, as crazy as that sounds." For psychological safety to emerge among a group, teammates don't have to be friends. They do, however, need to be socially sensitive and ensure everyone feels heard. The best tactic for establishing psychological safety is demonstration by a team leader, as Amy Edmondson, who is now a professor at Harvard Business School, told me. It seems like fairly minor stuff, but when the leader goes out of their way to make someone feel listened to, or starts a meeting by saying, "I might miss something, so I need all of you to watch for my mistakes," or says, Jim, you haven't spoken in a while. What do you think? That makes a huge difference. In Edmondson's hospital studies, the teams with the highest levels of psychological safety were also the ones with leaders most likely to model listening and social sensitivity. They invited people to speak up. They talked about their own emotions. They didn't interrupt other people. When someone was concerned or upset, they showed the group that it was okay to intervene. They tried to anticipate how people would react and then work to accommodate those reactions. This is how teams encourage people to disagree while still being honest with one another and occasionally clashing. This is how psychological safety emerges. By giving everyone an equal voice and encouraging social sensitivity among teammates. Michaels himself says the job of modeling norms is his most important duty. Everyone who comes through this show is different, and I have to show each of them that I'm treating them different, and show everyone else I'm treating them different, if we want to draw the unique brilliance out of everyone, Michaels told me. SNL only works when we have different writing and performing styles all bumping into and meshing with each other, he said. That's my job, to protect people's distinct voices, but also to get them to work together. I want to preserve whatever made each person special before they came to the show, but also help everyone be sensitive enough to make the rough edges fit. That's the only way we can do a new show every week without everyone wanting to kill each other as soon as we're done. 4. By the summer of 2015, the Google researchers working on Project Aristotle had been collecting surveys, conducting interviews, running regressions, and analyzing statistics for 2 years. They had scrutinized tens of thousands of pieces of data and had written dozens of software programs to analyze trends. Finally, they were ready to reveal their conclusions to the company's employees. They scheduled a meeting at the headquarters in Mountain View. Thousands of employees showed up, and many more watched via video stream. Laszlo Bock, the head of the People Operations Department at Google, walked onto the stage and thanked everyone for coming. The biggest thing you should take away from this work is that how teams work matters, in a lot of ways, more than who is on them, he said. He had spoken to me before he went on stage. There's a myth we all carry inside our head, Bock said. We think we need superstars, but that's not what our research found. You can take a team of average performers, and if you teach them to interact the right way, they'll do things no superstar could ever accomplish. And there's other myths, like sales teams should be run differently than engineering teams, or the best teams need to achieve consensus around everything, or high-performing teams need a high volume of work to stay engaged, or teams need to be physically located together. But now we can say those aren't right. The data shows there's a universality to how good teams succeed. It's important that everyone on a team feels like they have a voice, but whether they actually get to vote on things or make decisions turns out not to matter much. Neither does the volume of work or physical co-location. What matters is having a voice and social sensitivity. On stage, Bock brought up a series of slides. What matters are 5 key norms, he told the audience. Teams need to believe that their work is important. Teams need to feel their work is personally meaningful. Teams need clear goals and defined roles. Team members need to know they can depend on one another. But most important, teams need psychological safety. To create psychological safety, Bock said, team leaders needed to model the right behaviors. There were Google-designed checklists they could use. Leaders should not interrupt teammates during conversations, because that will establish an interrupting norm. They should demonstrate they are listening by summarizing what people say after they said it. They should admit what they don't know. They shouldn't end a meeting until all team members have spoken at least once. They should encourage people who are upset to express their frustrations and encourage teammates to respond in non-judgmental ways. They should call out intergroup conflicts and resolve them through open discussion. There were dozens of tactics on the checklist. All of them, however, came back to two general principles. Teams succeed when everyone feels like they can speak up, and when members show they are sensitive to how one another feels. There are lots of small things a leader can do, Abir Dubey told me. In meetings, does the leader cut people off by saying, "Let me ask a question there," or does she wait until someone is done speaking? How does the leader act when someone's upset? These things are so subtle, but they can have a huge impact. Every team is different, and it's not uncommon in a company like Google for engineers or salespeople to be taught to fight for what they believe in. But you need the right norms to make arguments productive rather than destructive. Otherwise, a team never becomes stronger. For 3 months, Project Aristotle traveled from division to division, explaining their findings and coaching team leaders. Google's top executives released tools that any team could use to evaluate if members felt psychologically safe, and worksheets to help leaders and teammates improve their scores. I come from a quantitative background. If I'm going to believe something, you need to give me data to back it up, said Sognik Nandi, who as chief of Google Analytics Engineering heads one of the company's biggest teams. So seeing this data has been a game changer for me. Engineers love debugging software because we know we can get 10% more efficiency by just making a few tweaks. But we never focus on debugging human interactions. We put great people together and hope it will work. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. And most of the time we don't know why. Aristotle let us debug our people. It's totally changed how I run meetings. I'm so much more conscious of how I model listening now, or whether I interrupt, or how I encourage everyone to speak. The project has had an impact on the Aristotle team as well. A couple of months ago, we were in a meeting where I made a mistake, Julia Rozovsky told me. Not a huge mistake, but an embarrassing one. And afterward, I sent out a note explaining what had gone wrong, why it had happened, and what we were doing to resolve it. Right afterward, I got an email back from a team member that just said, "Ouch." It was like a punch to the gut. I was already upset about making this mistake, and this note totally played on my insecurities. But because of all the work we've done, I pinged the person back and said, "Nothing like a good ouch to destroy psychological safety in the morning." And he wrote back and said, "I'm just testing your resilience." That could have been the wrong thing to say to someone else, but he knew it was exactly what I needed to hear. With one 30-second interaction, we diffused the tension. It's funny to do a project on team effectiveness while working on a team, because we get to test everything we're learning as we go along. What I've realized is that as long as everyone feels like they can talk, and we're really demonstrating that we want to hear each other, you feel like everyone's got your back. Over the last two decades, the American workplace has become much more team-focused. The average worker today might belong to a sales team, as well as a group of unit managers, a special team planning future projects, and the team overseeing the holiday party. Executives belong to groups that oversee compensation and strategy and hiring and firing and approving HR policies and figuring out how to cut costs. These teams might meet every day in person or correspond via email or telecommute from all over the world. Teams are important. Within companies and conglomerates, government agencies and schools, teams are now the fundamental unit of self-organization. And the unwritten rules that make teams succeed or fail, it turns out, are the same from place to place. The way investment bankers coordinate their efforts might seem different from how orthopedic nurses divvy up tasks, and the specific norms in those different settings will likely vary. But one thing will remain true if those teams work well. In both places, the groups will feel a sense of psychological safety. They will succeed because teammates feel they can trust each other, and that honest discussion can occur without fear of retribution. Their members will have roughly equal voices. Teammates will show they are sensitive to one another's emotions and needs. In general, the route to establishing psychological safety begins with the team's leader. So if you are leading a team, be it a group of coworkers or a sports team, a church gathering, or your family dinner table, think about what message your choices send. Are you encouraging equality in speaking or rewarding the loudest people? Are you modeling listening? Are you demonstrating a sensitivity to what people think and feel? Or are you letting decisive leadership be an excuse for not paying as close attention as you should? There are always good reasons for choosing behaviors that undermine psychological safety. It is often more efficient to cut off debate, to make a quick decision, to listen to whoever knows the most, and ask others to hold their tongues. But a team will become an amplification of its internal culture, for better or worse. Study after study shows that while psychological safety might be less efficient in the short run, it's more productive over time. If motivation comes from giving individuals a greater sense of control, then psychological safety is the caveat we must remember when individuals come together in a group. Establishing control requires more than just seizing self-determination. Being a subversive works, unless you're leading a team. When people come together in a group, sometimes we need to give control to others. That's ultimately what team norms are. Individuals willingly giving a measure of control to their teammates. But that works only when people feel like they can trust one another. It only succeeds when we feel psychologically safe. As a team leader, then, it's important to give people control. Some team leaders at Google make check marks next to people's names each time they speak, and won't end a meeting until those checks are all roughly equivalent. And as a team member, we share control by demonstrating that we are genuinely listening, by repeating what someone just said, by responding to their comments, by showing we care by reacting when someone seems upset or flustered, rather than acting as if nothing is wrong. When we defer to others' judgment, when we vocally treat others' concerns as our own, we give control to the group, and psychological safety takes hold. The thing I love most is when I see a sketch performed and the actors are really killing it on stage, and the sketch's writers are high-fiving each other by the monitor, and whoever is waiting in the wings is laughing, and there's another team already figuring out how to make the characters funnier next time, Lorne Michaels told me. When I see the entire team drawing some kind of inspiration from the same thing, I know everything is working, he said. At that moment, the whole team is rooting for each other, and each person feels like the star. Chapter 3. Focus. Cognitive tunneling, Air France Flight 447, and the power of mental models. When they finally found the wreckage, it was clear that few of the victims had realized disaster was near, even as it struck. There was no evidence of passengers' last-minute buckling of seatbelts or frenzied raising of food trays. Oxygen masks were firmly encased in ceiling panels. A submarine probing the wreckage at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean found a whole row of seats upright in the sand, as if waiting to fly again. It had taken almost 2 years to find the plane's data recorders, and everyone hoped that once they were retrieved, the cause of the accident would become clear at last. Initially, however, the recorders offered few clues. None of the plane's computers had malfunctioned, according to the data. There was no indication of mechanical failure or electrical glitch. It wasn't until investigators listened to the cockpit voice recordings that they began to understand. This Airbus, one of the largest and most sophisticated aircraft ever built, a plane designed to be an error-proof model of automation, was at the bottom of the ocean, not because of a defect in machinery, but because of a failure of attention. 23 months earlier, on May 31, 2009, the night sky was clear as Air France Flight 447 pulled away from the gate in Rio de Janeiro with 228 people on board, bound for Paris. In the cabin were honeymooners and a former conductor for the Washington National Opera, a well-known arms control activist, and an 11-year-old boy headed to boarding school. One of the plane's pilots had brought his wife to Rio so they could enjoy a 3-day layover at the Copacabana beach. Now she was in the back of the massive aircraft, while he and two colleagues were in the cockpit flying them home. As the plane began its ascent, there were a few radioed exchanges with air traffic control, the standard chatter that accompanies any takeoff. 4 minutes after lifting from the runway, the pilot in the right seat, the junior position, activated the autopilot. For the next 10.5 hours, if all went according to plan, the plane would essentially fly itself. Just 2 decades earlier, flying from Rio to Paris had been a much more taxing affair. Prior to the 1990s and advances in cockpit automation, pilots were responsible for calculating dozens of variables during a flight, including airspeed, fuel consumption, direction, and optimal cruising altitude, all while monitoring weather disturbances, discussions with air traffic control, and the plane's position in the sky. Such trips were so demanding that pilots often rotated responsibilities. They all knew the risks if vigilance waned. In 1987, a pilot in Detroit had become so overwhelmed during takeoff that he had forgotten to set the wing flaps. 154 people died when the plane crashed after takeoff. 15 years before that, pilots flying near Miami had become fixated on a faulty landing gear light and had failed to notice that they were gradually descending. 101 people were killed when the craft slammed into the Everglades. Before automated aviation systems were invented, it wasn't unheard of for more than 1,000 people to die each year in airplane accidents, often because pilots' attention spans were stretched too thin or due to other human errors. The plane flying from Rio to Paris, however, had been designed to eliminate such mistakes by vastly reducing the number of decisions a pilot had to make. The Airbus A330 was so advanced that its computers could automatically intervene when problems arose, identify solutions, and then tell pilots, via on-screen instructions, where to direct their focus as they responded to computerized prompts. In optimal conditions, a human might fly for only about 8 minutes per trip during takeoff and landing. Planes like the A330 had fundamentally changed piloting from a proactive to a reactive profession. As a result, flying was easier. Accident rates went down, and airlines' productivity soared because more customers could travel with less crew. A transoceanic flight had once required as many as 6 pilots. By the time of Flight 447, thanks to automation, Air France needed only 2 people in the cockpit at any given time. 4 hours into the trip, midway between Brazil and Senegal, the plane crossed the equator. Most of the passengers would have been asleep. There were clouds from a tropical storm in the distance. The 2 men in the cockpit remarked on static electricity dancing across the windows, a phenomenon known as St. Elmo's fire. I'm dimming the lighting a bit to see outside, eh? Said Pierre-Cédric Bonin, the pilot whose wife was in the passenger cabin.
Yes, yes, the captain replied.
There was a third aviator in a small hold behind the cockpit taking a nap. The captain summoned the third man to switch places, and then left the two junior pilots at the controls so he could sleep. The plane was flying smoothly on full autopilot at 32,000 feet. 20 minutes later, there was a small bump from turbulence.
It might be a good idea to tell the passengers to buckle up, Bonin informed a stewardess over the intercom.
As the air surrounding the cockpit cooled, three metal cylinders jutting from the craft's body, the pitot tubes, which measure airspeed by detecting the force of air flowing into them, became clogged with ice crystals. For almost 100 years, aviators have complained about, and safely accommodated, ice and pitot tubes. Most pilots know that if their airspeed measurement plunges unexpectedly, it's likely because of clogged pitot tubes. When the pitot tubes on Flight 447 froze over, the plane's computers lost airspeed information, and the autoflight system turned off, as it was programmed to do. A warning alarm sounded.
I have the controls, Bonin said calmly.
Okay, his colleague replied.
At this point, if the aviators had done nothing at all, the plane would have continued flying safely, and the pitot tubes would have eventually thawed. But Bonin, perhaps shaken out of a reverie by the alarm and wanting to offset the loss of the autopilot, pulled back a bit on the command stick, causing the plane's nose to nudge upward and the aircraft to gain altitude. Within 1 minute, it had ascended by 3,000 feet. With Flight 447's nose now pointed slightly upward, the plane's aerodynamics began to change. The atmosphere at that height was thin, and the ascent had disrupted the smooth flow of air over the plane's wings. The craft's lift, the basic force of physics that pulls airplanes into the sky because there is less pressure above a wing than below it, began deteriorating. In extreme conditions, this can cause an aerodynamic stall, a dangerous situation in which a plane starts falling even as its engines strain with thrust and the nose points skyward. A stall is easy to overcome in its early stages. Simply lowering the nose so air begins flowing smoothly over the wings prevents a stall from emerging. But if a plane's nose remains upward, a stall will become worse and worse until the airplane drops like a stone in a well. As Flight 447 rose through the thin atmosphere, a loud chime erupted in the cockpit, and a recorded voice began warning, "Stall, stall, stall, stall," indicating that the plane's nose was pointed too high.
"What's this?" the co-pilot said.
"There's no good, no good speed indication?" Bonin responded. The pitot tubes were still clogged with ice, and so the display did not show any airspeed.
"Pay attention to your speed," the co-pilot said.
"Okay, okay, I'm descending," Bonin replied.
"It says we're going up," the co-pilot said. "So descend."
"Okay," said Bonin.
But Bonin didn't descend. If he had leveled the plane, the craft would have flown on safely. Instead, he continued pulling back on the stick slightly, pushing the airplane's nose further into the sky. Automation has today penetrated nearly every aspect of our lives. Most of us now drive cars equipped with computers that automatically engage the brakes and reduce transmission power when we hit a patch of rain or ice, often so subtly we never notice the vehicle has anticipated our tendency to overcorrect. We work in offices where customers are routed to departments via computerized phone systems. Emails are automatically sent when we're away from our desks, and bank accounts are instantaneously hedged against currency fluctuations. We communicate with smartphones that finish our words. Even without technology's help,
All humans rely on cognitive automations, known as heuristics, that allow us to multitask. That's why we can email the babysitter while chatting with our spouse and simultaneously watching the kids. Mental automation lets us choose, almost subconsciously, what to pay attention to and what to ignore. Automations have made factories safer, offices more efficient, cars less accident-prone, and economies more stable. By one measure, there have been more gains in personal and professional productivity in the past 50 years than in the previous two centuries combined, much of it made possible by automation. But as automation becomes more common, the risks that our attention spans will fail have risen. Studies from Yale, UCLA, Harvard, Berkeley, NASA, the National Institutes of Health, and elsewhere show errors are particularly likely when people are forced to toggle between automaticity and focus, and are unusually dangerous as automatic systems infiltrate airplanes, cars, and other environments where a misstep can be tragic. In the age of automation, knowing how to manage your focus is more critical than ever before. Take, for instance, Bonin's mindset when he was forced to take control of Flight 447. It is unclear why he continued guiding the plane upward after agreeing with his co-pilot that they should descend. Maybe he hoped to climb above the storm clouds on the horizon. Perhaps it was an unintentional reaction to the sudden alarm. We will never know why he didn't return the controls to neutral once the stall warning sounded. There is significant evidence, however, that Bonin was in the grip of what's known as cognitive tunneling, a mental glitch that sometimes occurs when our brains are forced to transition abruptly from relaxed automation to panicked attention. You can think about your brain's attention span like a spotlight that can go wide and diffused or tight and focused, said David Strayer, a cognitive psychologist at the University of Utah. Our attention span is guided by our intentions. We choose, in most situations, whether to focus the spotlight or let it be relaxed. But when we allow automated systems, such as computers or autopilots, to pay attention for us, our brains dim that spotlight and allow it to swing wherever it wants. This is, in part, an effort by our brains to conserve energy. The ability to relax in this manner gives us huge advantages. It helps us subconsciously control stress levels and makes it easier to brainstorm. It means we don't have to constantly monitor our environment, and it helps us get ready for big cognitive tasks. Our brains automatically seek out opportunities to disconnect and unwind. But then, bam, some kind of emergency happens, or you get an unexpected email, or someone asks you an important question in a meeting, and suddenly the spotlight in your head has to ramp up all of a sudden, and, at first, it doesn't know where to shine, said Strayer. So the brain's instinct is to force it as bright as possible on the most obvious stimuli, whatever's right in front of you, even if that's not the best choice. That's when cognitive tunneling happens. Cognitive tunneling can cause people to become overly focused on whatever is directly in front of their eyes or become preoccupied with immediate tasks. It's what keeps someone glued to their smartphone as the kids wail or pedestrians swerve around them on the sidewalk. It's what causes drivers to slam on their brakes when they see a red light ahead. We can learn techniques to get better at toggling between relaxation and concentration, but they require practice and a desire to remain engaged. However, once in a cognitive tunnel, we lose our ability to direct our focus. Instead, we latch onto the easiest and most obvious stimulus, often at the cost of common sense. As the pitot tubes iced over and the alarms blared, Bonin entered a cognitive tunnel. His attention had been relaxed for the past 4 hours. Now, amid flashing lights and ringing bells, His attention searched for a focal point. The most obvious one was the video monitor right in front of his eyes. The cockpit of an Airbus A330 is a minimalist masterpiece, an environment designed to be distraction-free, with just a few screens alongside a modest number of gauges and controls. One of the most prominent screens, directly in each pilot's line of sight, is the primary flight display. There is a broad line running across the horizontal center of a screen that indicates the division between sky and land. Floating atop this line is the small icon of an aircraft. If a plane rolls to either side while flying, the icon goes off kilter, and pilots know their wings are no longer parallel to the ground. When Bonin heard the alarm and looked at his instrument panel, he saw the primary flight display. The icon of the plane on that screen had rolled slightly to the right. Normally, this would not have been a concern. Planes roll in small increments throughout a trip and are easily righted. But now, with the autopilot disengaged and the sudden pressure to focus, the spotlight inside Bonin's head shined on that off-kilter icon. Bonin, data records indicate, became focused on getting the wings of that icon level with the middle of his screen. And then, perhaps because he was fixated on correcting the roll, he failed to notice that he was still pulling back on the control stick, lifting the plane's nose. As Bonin pulled back on his stick, the front of the aircraft rose higher. Then, another instance of cognitive tunneling occurred, this time inside the head of Bonin's co-pilot. The man in the left-hand seat was named David Robert, and he was officially the monitoring pilot. His job was to keep watch over Bonin and intervene if the flying pilot became overwhelmed. In a worst-case scenario, Robert could take control of the craft. But now, with alarm sounding, Robert did what's most natural in such a situation. He became focused on the most obvious stimuli. There was a screen next to him spewing text as the plane's computer provided updates and instructions. Robert turned his eyes away from Bonin and began staring at the scrolling type, reading the messages aloud. "Stabilize," Robert said. "Go back down." Focused on the screen as he was, Robert didn't see that Bonin was pulling back on his stick and didn't register that the flying pilot was raising the craft higher even as he agreed they needed to descend. There is no evidence that Robert looked at his gauges. Instead, he frantically scrolled through a series of messages automatically generated by the plane's computer. Even if those prompts had been helpful, nothing indicates that Bonin, locked on the airplane icon in front of him, heard anything his colleagues said. The plane rose through 35,000 feet, drawing dangerously close to its maximum height. The nose of the airplane was now pitched at 12 degrees. The co-pilot finally looked away from his screen. "We're climbing, according to this," he told Bonin, referring to the instrument panel. "Go back down," he shouted. "Okay," Bonin replied. Bonin pushed his stick forward, forcing the plane's nose to dip slightly. As a result, the force of gravity against the pilots lessened by a third, giving them a brief sense of weightlessness. "Gently," his colleague snapped. Then Bonin, perhaps overwhelmed by the combination of the alarms, the weightlessness, and his co-pilot's chastisement, jerked his hand backward, arresting the descent of the plane's nose. The craft remained at a 6-degree upward pitch. Another loud warning chime came from the cockpit's speakers, and a few seconds later, the aircraft began to shake, what's known as buffeting, the result of rough air moving across the wings in the early stages of a serious aerodynamic stall.
We're in a climb, I think," Bonin said.
For the next 10 seconds, neither man spoke. The plane rose above its maximum recommended altitude of 37,500 feet. To stay aloft, Flight 447 had to descend. If Bonin would simply lower the nose, all would be fine. Then, as